WHUS Doors 91.7 FM.
Say you want a revolution, well, you know, we all want to change the world. You tell me that it's evolution, well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction,
well, good evening to you, and welcome to Naked Lunch Radio here at 91.7 WHUS. I'm your host and producer, Dean Farrell, and I'll be with you for the next hour. Going to start off this week with the Atheist Prayer. Our logic, which art in our heads, hallowed be thy wisdom. Thy enlightenment come, thy reasoned will be done on earth as it actually is. Give us this day our daily needs, and guard us from our fallacies. As we correct those who indoctrinate their children, and lead us not into delusion, but deliver us from ignorance. For thine is the sanctity of thought, and the wonder, and all progress, forever and ever. Hell yeah. All right, this first article comes from antiwar.com, or as the good folks at Democratic Underground like to call it, that anti-Semitic hate site, because, of course, anybody who even mildly criticizes Israel is anti-Semitic, don't you know? Anyway, this is by Michael Schuer, and it's called "The Lobby Like No Other Wants a War Like No Other." Having watched John McCain and Barack Obama resolutely pledge their allegiance and their countrymen's lives and treasures to the defense of Israel via AIPAC, that's the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, by the way, the media, and personal meetings with Israeli leaders, it is worth asking what could possibly drive these men to so ardently commit the U.S. to participation in other people's religious wars. This question is particularly important today as the Bush administration and the Israel Firsters continue to push for an unprovoked U.S. attack on Iran. I harbor no resentment over the actions of Israel's leaders. For more than 60 years, they have knowingly made their country a pariah in the Arab and Islamic worlds, just as the Palestinians have made themselves pariahs in much of the West. That is, of course, the right of both parties, but neither seems to want to face the consequences of their decisions. With demographic realities and increasingly radical, well-armed Arabs making them panicky about Israel's security, Israel's leaders naturally try to lock down as much U.S. support as possible. Having consciously, if unwisely, put all their eggs in the U.S. basket since the 1973 war, Israel's leaders must do everything possible to protect their relationship with Washington. The U.S. invasion of Iraq, it seems, was not enough for the Israel Firsters. Now, according to Senator Joseph Lieberman, a U.S.-launched war on Iran is needed because, quote, the threat that the U.S. and Israel face from the Islamic Republic of Iran is today greater than ever, close quote. Though based on the fantasy that Ahmadinejad's tin-pot regime is a threat to the world's only superpower, this is a perfectly common-sense position for Israel and its U.S. citizen backers in AIPAC to champion. In their view, U.S. wars with Muslims are the ultimate good for Israel. Recall, if you will, the perfectly accurate April 2008 words of Benjamin Netanyahu, likely Israel's next prime minister. Israel is benefiting from one thing, and that is the attack on the Twin Towers in the Pentagon and the American struggle in Iraq. These wars, Netanyahu said, have swung American public opinion in our favor. My own anger falls not on Israel, then, or on Palestine, for that matter. As I have written elsewhere, America would do just fine and would be better off without either or both. It falls rather on the lobbying efforts of AIPAC, that organization's blatant purchasing of fealty from U.S. politicians in both parties, and the media's obsequious parroting of specious canards about Israel's right to exist and the duty of Americans to support an island of democracy in the Middle East. While few would question the right of AIPAC leaders to lobby U.S. politicians and legally bribe them with campaign contributions, or limit their right to speak as they please in public, no matter how scurrilous or libelous their words, I sometimes wonder if Americans have focused on what AIPAC lobbies for, and what its acolytes in politics and the media support. It is commonplace to say that lobbying is a pervasive activity in U.S. politics at all levels of government, especially at the federal level. Across this diverse array of lobbyists, there were two common threads. A, none are working to push the United States to participate in other people's wars. And B, all are arguing for things that will, from their perspective, improve America, whether by making it richer, better protected, more completely educated, healthier, freer, etc. The anti-gun lobby, for example, is no less confident than the NRA and its affiliates that they are working for the best interest of Americans. One or the other is wrong, but their activities are shaped by their perception of what is best for America. It is this last point that separates the lobbyists working for and with AIPAC, most of whom are U.S. citizens, from almost all other U.S.-based lobbyists. AIPAC does not lobby, bribe, and libel to make America better off. It lobbies solely, forthrightly, and cynically to make Israel richer, better protected, and able to do as it pleases in its relationships with Muslim states. AIPAC makes no pretense of doing things to benefit America. Rather, its members take pride in seeking a goal that runs directly counter to the economic welfare and physical security of almost all other U.S. citizens by seeking to keep them involved in a religious war in which no U.S. national interest is at stake. Now, there are a few other similar anti-American lobbies, those for Armenia, Lebanon, Greece, etc., but AIPAC is clearly primus inter pares, hope I pronounced that right, in this dastardly group. And given that every AIPAC success is a net loss for U.S. security and the U.S. Treasury, it seems odd that our so-called political leaders take orders and funds from this fundamentally anti-U.S. organization. Odd or not, however, that is the reality. Senators Obama and McCain have become AIPAC poster boys, each strengthening his support for Israel over the course of the current presidential campaign. Obama's position, in fact, has changed so drastically in a pro-Israel direction that the Illinois senator appears to have no mind of his own on this issue. He has simply and obsequiously adopted the Democrats' traditional abject subservience to their small but powerful pro-Israel constituency. McCain is an Israel firster of the deepest hue. Coached by Lieberman, McCain is now considering Republican Congressman Eric Cantor for his running mate. Cantor is eager to spend American blood and treasure to secure Israel. Speaking in Israel, Cantor pushed the same false assertion that is the staple of U.S. leaders in both parties. Quote, "What befalls Jerusalem threatens the security of the United States and its allies worldwide. That's because Jerusalem and Israel are ground zero in the global battle against tyranny and democracy, radicalism and moderation, terrorism and freedom." Close quote. This, of course, is nonsense of a high order, and Lieberman and Cantor know it. Both men are committed to Israel as a religious idea, not because it has anything to do with U.S. security. According to Lieberman, "The rabbis say in the Talmud that a lot of rabbinic law is to put a fence around the Torah so you don't get near to violating it." Well, McCain has a series of very clear-headed policies toward terrorism and Islamic extremism that put extra layers behind his support for Israel. End of quote there. He also told a conference of Christians United for Israel that he was pleased they recognized it was America's duty to defend Israel, blithely lying to them that President Washington and the Founding Fathers would support America fighting Israel's wars. Cantor, playing to both the Israel firsters and their U.S. evangelical allies, also has made clear where his primary loyalty lies. "Jerusalem is not merely the capital of Israel, but the spiritual capital of Jews and Christians everywhere. It's the site of the first and second temples, which house the Holy of Holies, and it's the direction in which we Jews face when we pray. This glorious city of David is bound to the Jewish people by an undeniable 3,000-year historical link." My own view is that if God promised Palestine to the Israelis, that God is perfectly capable of keeping that promise, and America is in no way committed to expend the lives of its soldier children in a war over conflicting interpretations of God's words. The Israelis and the Muslims should be perfectly free to fight over whether Yahweh or Abraham or Allah and Muhammad are right, and Americans should be perfectly free to draw the correct conclusion that the United States does not have a dog in this fight. In addition, there's a genuine constitutional question of church-state separation on this issue. Why should American taxpayers have their earnings and their children's lives spent to defend a theocracy in Israel, or for that matter, to protect an Islamic theocracy in Saudi Arabia?
Imagine the howls of protest and torrents of church-state separation rhetoric from the media and both parties. If a congressman introduced a bill calling for the U.S. to designate that an amount equivalent to what's spent to protect Israel and Saudi Arabia be sent to the Vatican, a nation-state like Israel and Saudi Arabia, to improve its defenses against the now well-articulated threat from al-Qaeda and other Islamists. Obviously, three realities are clear. One, U.S. survival is not at stake in the Israeli-Muslim war. Two, the taxes of Americans should not be spent to defend theocratic states. And three, holy books are insane tools to use as guide for U.S. foreign policy. In America, however, these realities lie unspoken because of the lobbying efforts of AIPAC and the pro-Israel mantras of the politicians it purchases with campaign contributions and promises of media exposure, including McCain and Obama. By their consistent anti-American actions, AIPAC and the U.S. politicians who do its bidding have fully validated the words of the real George Washington, not the figment of Washington painted by Joe Lieberman. In 1796, President Washington wrote, "Against the insidious wiles of foreign influence, the jealousy of a free people ought to be constantly awake, since history and experience prove that foreign influence is one of the most baneful woes of Republican government." That's small r Republican, by the way. And again, that was Michael Schuer writing at antiwar.com. The article was titled, "The Lobby, Like No Other, Wants a War Like No Other." It's 12 minutes after 6. You're listening to Naked Lunch Radio with Dean Farrell on WHUS 91.7 FM, Yukon's radio for the people. By the way, starting with this show, podcasts of Naked Lunch Radio will now be available, courtesy of radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4all.net. Just go to their search engine, type in Naked Lunch Radio, and beginning with this week's episode, you can get podcasts of the show, in case you're interested. Okay, this next article was written by Glenn Ford of Black Agenda Report, and the headline reads, "New York Times attempts to define and dictate black politics." The New York Times, the nation's preeminent corporate mouthpiece, has unabashedly called for the dissolution of independent black politics in the United States. Although the paper's Sunday magazine cover story may seem at first skim, it's a little hard to read there, to be simply an overlong peon to Barack Obama, its intent goes way beyond the presidential race and is embedded in the title, "Is Obama the End of Black Politics?" Author Matt Bai and his employers fervently hope the answer is yes. The wishful headline sits atop a pile of false assumptions and outright untruths about contemporary and historical black politics. Hardly a cogent set of facts can be found in the entire piece. It is composed almost entirely of unsubstantiated assertions mixed with non sequiturs and quotation marks, but the thrust is quite clear. African Americans have not only outgrown group politics, as supposedly proven by Obama's March 2 rather than on the White House, but Obama's brand of race neutrality shows that black politics is obsolete and should be abandoned. To arrive at such a racially presumptuous conclusion, Bai must build on several false or debatable premises that have nevertheless become accepted wisdom among the corporate media. Number one, the only authentic black politics is electoral politics. Mass movements, direct action, and other non-electoral strategies are relics of the past, and rightly so. More black faces in high places automatically equals black progress, regardless of the political content of these office holders' policies. It is an unquestionable sign of general black progress when African-American candidates gain white support. Number two, black solidarity must decline and ultimately fade away as a political motivator as opportunities for some African-Americans expand. A growing black middle class inevitably leads to increased black political conservatism. Blacks have no legitimate reasons to pursue political solidarity except those directly related to the upward mobility of their class. And number three, a unique and pronounced age gap exists in black America, and that stands in the way of transition to a less confrontational, more cooperative society. Black elders are the bottleneck in this regard. Young blacks are politically more mature than older blacks, since they're further removed from the events of the 60s and are thus not plagued by disturbing memories. Based on these assumptions, Times readers may conclude that African Americans who struggle for group rights and objectives are behaving like superannuated dodderers in their second childhoods. Matt Bai thinks so. The following sentence gives new meaning to the term convoluted reasoning. For a lot of younger African Americans, the resistance of the civil rights generation to Obama's candidacy signified the failure of their parents to come to terms at the dusk of their lives with the success of their own struggle, to embrace the idea that black politics might now be disappearing into American politics in the same way that the Irish and Italian machines long ago joined the political mainstream. Amazing, isn't it, that Bai and his ilk purport to know about black youth and their elders than the two black age cohorts know about each other? Indeed, if we're to follow Bai's logic to its natural conclusion, then whites understand and communicate with young blacks better than black parents do. It all makes sense once you accept the assumption that young blacks think more like whites than their parents, whose minds have been deformed by too close an exposure to the nightmarish 60s, during which time they became distrustful of white people and have never recovered. Fortunately, we can dismiss Bai's assault on black elders out of hand, since it relies on facts nowhere in evidence. Where are the graying black legions that are resisting Obama's candidacy as a bloc? Every black demographic, no matter how you slice it, is overwhelmingly pro-Obama. How could it not be so? With the black Obama vote in the late primaries hitting 90-95%. For every aging black radical, like me, who refuses to drink the Obama-lade, there were 8 of his peers with Obama signs on their front lawns, and 3 octogenarians thanking God they have lived long enough to vote for such an attractive, well-spoken, young black man who might actually become president. Such is the near irresistible pull of race and race solidarity, the uncontainable pressure of the pent-up aspirations of centuries, finally finding vent in this election cycle. Bai followed his assumptions off a cliff with the old black folks don't like Obama idea. But he must maintain the fiction of a general age chasm dividing black Americans, or the theory on the inevitable extinction of black politics does not work. And it must work, since Bai opens his piece with an attempt to prove that age was an important factor in the early dead-even split in the Congressional Black Caucus, or CBC, between Clinton and Obama supporters. Presumably, the 15 Hillary supporters were among those elders who could not come to terms at the dusk of their lives with the success of their own struggle. An equal number were committed to Obama. The rest were undecided. As it turned out, there was no chronological or ideological pattern in the CBC's Clinton-Obama lineup in early January. Charles Rangel of New York, the oldest member, was in the Clinton column. John Conyers of Michigan, the second oldest, voted for Obama. Barbara Lee, among the most consistently progressive members, backed Clinton, but so did David Scott of Georgia, once dubbed the worst black congressman for his relatively right-wing voting habits. Bobby Rush, the former Black Panther, who, according to Bai's reasoning, should have been the most resistant to Obama's neutralism on race, was in his fellow Chicagoan's corner. The CBC presidential breakdown had little or nothing to do with age, or with any issues of deep substance, for that matter. Members aligned themselves at that early date based on considerations of money, petty faction, geography, and the betting odds. Until Obama's victory in Iowa, polls showed the black vote still very much in play. Only when African Americans were confident that large numbers of whites would vote for Obama did they massively align with the black candidate, and then they quickly became a bloc. Nowhere is there evidence of a decisive schism, certainly not around age. Here's where Bai came the closest to getting anything right. The generational transition that is reordering black politics didn't start this year. It has been happening, gradually and quietly, for at least a decade. As younger African Americans, Barack Obama among them, have challenged their elders in traditionally black districts. What this year's Democratic nomination fight did was to accelerate that transition. A change has come over black politics in the last decade, and it does involve the entrance of a relatively young crop of black politicians. However, the decisive factor here is not age, but money. Corporate America made a strategic decision to become active players in black democratic politics, an arena they had largely avoided in post-60s decades. In 2002, the corporate right fielded and heavily funded 3 black Democratic candidates for high-profile offices in majority black contests. 2 of them, Newark Mayor Cory Booker and Alabama Congressman Arthur Davis, are featured in Matt Bai's Times article. No surprise there. The duo appear in every corporate media article celebrating the rise of new young black corporate politicians. The third big business favorite, Denise Majet, has since slipped back into political obscurity. Booker, then a first-team city councilman, was and remains a darling of the vast political network centered on the far-right Bradley Foundation of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. George W. Bush calls Bradley his favorite foundation, as well he should. Since Bradley and its think tanks developed the GOP's faith-based initiatives and private school voucher strategies, Booker became a star of the Bradley-subsidized vouchers quote-unquote movement. In his first unsuccessful run for Newark City Hall, Booker far outspent four-term mayor Sharp James, the most powerful black politician in the state, but was narrowly defeated when his ties to school vouchers and far-right money were revealed. Booker was endorsed by every corporate media outlet in the New York metropolitan area, thanks to the ministrations of Bradley's media-savvy think tank, the Manhattan Institute. Booker captured the office easily in 2006 after amassing an even bigger war chest when Mayor James declined to run. James was later convicted on corruption charges and sentenced to 27 months in prison. Less than a month later, former Birmingham prosecutor Arthur Davis, then 34, made a second run against veteran Congressman Earl Hilliard in a 62% black district. Davis had been badly beaten by Hilliard in the Democratic primary in 2000. This time, he outspent Hilliard by more than 50%, with the vast bulk of his funds raised outside the district. Davis won a minority of the black vote to beat Hilliard. 2 months later, in August of 2002, the corporate-funded juggernaut rolled into Atlanta, where five-term Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney faced former black Republican Denise Majet in an open Democratic primary. Majet's bankroll dwarfed McKinney's. Majet was also backed by every corporate media outlet in the region and far beyond. The massed national corporate press turned McKinney-Majet into a national story, an opportunity to refine their collective analysis of post-60s black politics. Majet would win, they agreed, because McKinney's 60s-style politics were unsuited to her suburban Atlanta district, the second most affluent black district in the country. The corporate media declared with certainty, but with no facts to buttress the claim, that the African-American middle class was becoming more conservative, and a younger generation yearned for a break from the confrontations of the past. Majet won, but with only about 17% of the black vote. She was the white choice. McKinney, the fiery progressive, was the overwhelming favorite among blacks in a district that was the perfect test for the corporate media's theories on black politics. They were proven wrong, but a useful lie trumps inconvenient facts. Through repetition in a monoculture corporate media, lies become truisms. Matt Bai's Sunday Times article is based on the same fact-devoid theory of black rightward political drift and a yawning age divide. Even before his national debut at the 2004 Democratic Convention, Barack Obama joined Cory Booker, Arthur Davis, and then-Representative Harold Ford Jr. of Tennessee as exhibits in an endless series of new black politics articles, each one a clone of the last. This is what Bai mistakenly calls the generational transition that is reordering black politics. It's not about age at all, other than that the young are hungrier and more malleable than their elders and thus better prospects to march under the corporate colors. Barack Obama does pose a dire threat to the coherence of black politics, but not for Matt Bai's reasons. Obama's presidential bid is inseparable from the ongoing corporate money and media campaign to confuse and destabilize the black polity, an offensive begun in earnest in 2002. Obama, a prescient and uncannily talented opportunist, understood which way the corporate wind was blowing at least a decade earlier and methodically readied himself for the role of his life. To the extent that African Americans expect more from Obama than they got from Bill Clinton, they will be devastatingly disappointed. His candidacy has at least temporarily caused black people to behave en masse as if there were no issues at stake in the election other than an Obama victory. It is altogether unclear how long this spell-like effect will last. The short-term prospects for rebuilding a coherent black politics are uncertain. But one thing we do know: the formation of a near-unanimous black bloc for Obama, of which he is absolutely unworthy, is stunning evidence that the black imperative to solidarity is undiminished. Unfortunately, the wrong guy is the beneficiary. But in a sense, that's beside the point. Black people are not working themselves into an election year frenzy just to commit political suicide by disbanding as a bloc, no matter what Matt Bai says. It is at least possible that a new era of agitation and militant organization might follow the monster comedown that must descend on black folks, either from an Obama defeat in November, or if victorious, through his ultimate and early betrayal of black self-generated hopes. But there's absolutely no reason to believe that African Americans will emerge from the experience in a mood to fold up their collective, consciously black political tent. Matt Bai is only able to envision such an outcome because he refuses to admit that the racial problem in the United States is caused by whites. Institutional racism is ingrained white behavior. The black prison gulag is a white creation. Double-digit unemployment and one-tenth wealth are the products of white privilege. White people constantly replenish black aspirations for self-determination, for a black politics. Bai pretends that he is genuinely concerned about how blacks will fare in the transition from black politics. Several black operatives and politicians with whom I spoke worried eloquently that an Obama presidency might actually leave black Americans less well-represented in Washington rather than more so. That, in fact, the end of black politics, if that is what we are witnessing, might also mean the precipitous decline of black influence. The argument here is that a President Obama, closely watched for signs of parochialism or racial resentment, would have less maneuvering room to champion spending on the urban poor, say, or to challenge racial injustice. What's more, his very presence in the Rose Garden might undermine the already tenuous case for affirmative action in hiring and school admissions. First, African Americans should believe Obama when he repeatedly assures whites that he does not recognize black claims to redress for past grievances and has little tolerance for race-based remedies of any kind. There can be no expectation of a net increase in black people's ability to alter societal power relationships with Obama in the White House. A black president might make some difference, but not this black president. And yes, there will be a white backlash. There always is. Even though blacks in general may materially gain nothing from Obama's change of address. White backlashes are beyond black control, but sometimes they spur African Americans to greater organizational efforts. At any rate, blacks don't need faux sympathy from Matt Bai in the New York Times. They're part of the reason that there will always be black politics. And once again, that was Glenn Ford writing at what's quickly become one of my favorite websites, blackagendareport.com. The piece was titled, New York Times Attempts to Define and Dictate Black Politics. It is 6:28. You're listening to Naked Lunch Radio with Dean Farrell here on WHUS. I'm on the air Saturdays from 6 to 7 p.m., featuring news, opinion, and other stuff that you generally won't find in the mainstream press. Right now, we're going to take 5 minutes to present this week's edition of Media Minutes from the good folks at freepress.net.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Next February, the United States will make the switch to digital television, allowing broadcasters to simulcast multiple channels over the air and making your old TV set rabbit ears obsolete. Most of the talk about the so-called DTV transition is focused on the converter boxes needed to view broadcasts with an analog TV set. But Bruce Dixon, managing editor of the Black Agenda Report, says that the media are ignoring a much bigger issue.
What you're not hearing is that digital TV will increase the number of TV channels from 4 to 10 times. And then what you're not also hearing is who those new channels are going to belong to. The fact is that they're going to belong to the same guys who already have the old channels.
On the same amount of spectrum that it takes to broadcast one analog channel, there will be space now to broadcast several channels, depending on what kind of data you'll be transmitting, high definition, standard definition, or data. Back in 1996, a deal was cut in Washington that kept the broadcasters in charge of all the extra spectrum.
Now, ever since they've had broadcast licensing, one license has meant one channel, but thanks to this deal that they hatched in 1996 that virtually no one knows about, the current holders of broadcast licenses will get these multiple new channels without the hassle of multiple new licenses.
In 1996, then-Senator Bob Dole called the deal a huge corporate welfare program.
The channels will not go to any community groups, to any non-for-profit broadcasters, to any new commercial players, any minorities, any women, but that these new stations will go only to the people who already have them.
Dixon says the opportunity to create new programming will be lost if people don't act quickly. He wants a public outcry strong enough to be heard in the halls of Congress. The perfect focus for a protest is the transition test that will be held in Wilmington, North Carolina, on September 8th.
If we want to make a mass breakthrough, if we want to get our messages across to mass audiences, then we've got to seize upon this opportunity. This is an opportunity to put hundreds or thousands of TV stations in the hands of other people who don't have TV stations right now.
To read Bruce Dixon's article, go to blackagendareport.com. Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick signed legislation that will bring high-speed internet access to areas in the state where it's currently unavailable. Within the next 3 years, the law calls for the expansion of broadband into 32 communities throughout the state.
This is good news. This is really important news because high-speed broadband is the gateway to the 21st century world. Whether it's economic or educational opportunity or civic access, access to government and ways to simplify our lives and get access to information. And yet 220,000 households all across the Commonwealth and some 25,000 or more businesses have very little, in many, many cases, no access at all to high-speed internet.
Patrick chose Goshen, Massachusetts, a tiny town tucked away in the hills of the rural western part of the state, as a backdrop for the bill signing. The festivities took place in the town hall parking lot that serves as the local wireless hotspot. Hilltown residents are more than ready for better internet service.
We need it. We desperately need it. The school kids need it. We need it for business. The factories aren't going to be coming back here, but little businesses will come back.
There have been times where I've considered doing an internet business and just I constantly drop it because our connection is so incredibly slow. I mean, basically, I get online and get up and do dishes or or I'm reading a book at the same time. I'm, you know, multitasking in order to not lose my mind.
The law provides $40 million in bonds and establishes the Massachusetts Broadband Institute, which will obtain federal and private support to expand access and bridge the digital divide with investments in fiber, wireless towers, and other broadband infrastructures. It's not clear if state-of-the-art technologies will be deployed in the Hilltowns, but to those stuck with dial-up, even DSL sounds good to them.
Well, we have internet at our school, so that's where we do most of our research, and then we go home and write it up. But if we don't get enough research time in at the school, then we jump for joy when we get 32K.
For more information about the new Massachusetts Broadband Institute, go to masstech.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And you can hear Media Minutes on Naked Lunch Radio every week at approximately the halfway mark of the show. It's 6:33. This is Dean Farrell with you until 7. Going to be devoting probably the rest of the show this week to a lengthy article by Joshua Holland from alternate.org. It's titled, Corporate America Prepares for Battle Against Worker Campaign to Roll Back Assault on the Middle Class. There's nothing more terrifying to corporate America than the prospect of dealing with its workforce on an even playing field. With its allies on the right, it's pulling out all the stops to keep that from happening. At stake is much more than the usual tax breaks, trade deals, and relentless deregulation. Corporations are gearing up for a fight to preserve a status quo in which the largest share of America's national income goes to profits and the smallest share to wages since the Great Depression. In fact, since the government started tracking those figures. There'll be many heated legislative battles if 2008 shakes out with larger congressional majorities for Democrats and an Obama White House. Fights over war and peace, energy policy, health care reform, and immigration. But it may be a bill many Americans have never heard of that sparks the most pitched battle Washington has seen since the Civil Rights Act. It's called the Employee Free Choice Act, or EFCA, a measure that would go a long way toward guaranteeing working people the right to join a union if they so choose. And it has the potential to reverse, more than three decades of painful stagflation, with prices rising and paychecks flat for America's middle class and working poor.
The Chamber of Commerce, D.C. lobbyists, firms that rely on cheap labor, and a host of AstroTurf front groups are building a war chest that could reach hundreds of millions of dollars in an effort to build a firewall against EFCA and other efforts to put a check on corporate power and rebuild a declining middle class. A recent report on the front page of the Wall Street Journal about how Walmart, the nation's largest employer, is mobilizing its store managers and department supervisors in an effort to discourage its workers from voting Democratic this fall, generated quite a bit of controversy. According to a report in the National Journal that received less attention, several business-backed groups, including two fledgling coalitions fighting labor-supported legislation, and the conservative political group Freedom's Watch, are trying to raise $100 million for issue advocacy and get out the vote efforts to benefit about 10 GOP Senate races. It's the EFCA, the idea that working people who want to join a union can, that has corporate America quaking in its collective boots. The bill passed the House easily in 2007 by 56 votes and had majority support in the Senate, but it didn't reach the 60 votes required to kill a GOP-led Senate filibuster. The massive war chest being amassed by the corporate right is in part an attempt to maintain a firewall of at least 41 anti-union senators, mostly Republicans joined by a few corporatist Democrats, to kill the bill in the 2009 Congress. George W. Bush threatened to veto the legislation if it had passed in 2007, but this time around they fear a Democrat in the White House. Obama was a co-sponsor of the 2007 legislation. McCain opposed it. The prospect of a filibuster-proof majority that's sympathetic to the needs of ordinary Americans, according to the National Journal, is making business groups jittery. Polls show that the economy is the American people's number one concern going into this fall's election. Fully 75% of Americans believe the country is on the wrong track, and these well-funded groups are intent on keeping it firmly on that track. In economic terms, the wages of many, probably most Americans, represent a market failure of massive proportions. Even the most devout free marketeers, economists like Alan Greenspan and the late Milton Friedman, agree that it's appropriate and necessary for government to intervene in the case of those failures. But the corporate right, which claims to have an almost religious reverence for the power of free and functional markets, has gotten fat off this particular market failure, and it's dead set on continuing to game the system for its own enrichment. About one in four Americans has at least a four-year college degree, and many of those degrees are even worth something in the labor market. Others, like Derek Jeter, Bill Gates, a gifted artist or a writer who can turn a decent phrase, have specialized skills that allow them to command an income that's as high as the market for their scarce talents will bear. There also are people with more common skills who have the scratch and fortitude and/or the connections to establish their own businesses. Think George W. Bush, or a really great mechanic who owns his or her own shop. That leaves a lot of people, about 80% of working Americans, who are hourly workers, wage slaves in the traditional sense. There is no doubt that their salaries are heavily influenced by the laws of supply and demand. We saw that clearly in the latter half of the 90s when, under Bill Clinton, the Fed allowed the economy to grow at a fast clip, unemployment dropped below 4%, and for a brief period, a three-decade spiral in inequality was reversed as wages grew for people in every income bracket. But a common fallacy is that wages are determined by market forces. They're not, for a variety of reasons that require more explanation than space permits. I'll focus on two. What economists call information asymmetries and coercion. Both are anathema to a functional free market, but both exist today in abundance in the American workplace. To understand the failures of the free market, one has to go back briefly to basic economic theory. For a free market transaction to work, both buyer and seller need to have a good grasp of what the product being sold, in this case people's sweat, is worth elsewhere, who else is buying and selling, etc. That is, they must have more or less equal access to information. There can be no misrepresentation by either buyer or seller in a free market transaction. And both parties have to enter into the transaction freely without being coerced. Neither side can exercise power or undue influence over the other, whether implicitly or explicitly, through threats or other means. Now, let's look at how that theoretical construct plays out in the real world of the American workplace. When an individual worker negotiates a price for their time, effort, and dedication with any business bigger than a mom-and-pop operation, there's quite a bit of explicit coercion, much of it in violation of our labor laws, which I'll get to shortly. But there's always an element of inherent coercion when an individual negotiates with a company alone because of the power differential. A company that's shorthanded by one person will continue to function, but a person without a job is unable to put a roof over his or her head or food on the table. The information asymmetries in such a negotiation are immense. They're actually more like process asymmetries. Companies spend millions of dollars on human resource experts, consultants, labor lawyers, etc. They know both the conditions of the market and the ins and outs of labor laws in intimate detail. While working people with rarefied skills are often members of trade associations or guilds, read trade journals, and have a pretty good sense of what the market will bear, many low and semi-skilled workers don't know their rights under the labor laws, don't know how to assert them, and rightfully fear reprisals when they do. They often have little knowledge of the financial health, or illness as the case may be, of the company to which they're applying for a job, how profitable it is, how much money similar workers make in other regions or firms, etc. For the majority of Americans who lack scarce talents or a high level of education, negotiating a price for one's time with a firm on an individual basis is anything but a free market transaction. That's where collective bargaining comes in. When workers bargain as a group, they do so on a level playing field with employers, and the resulting wages and benefits are as high as the market can bear, but no higher. Unions, like corporations, have a great deal of information about the market. They know how a firm is doing, how profitable it is, and where it is relative to the larger industry in which it operates. They know what deals, that workers at other plants have negotiated. They have attorneys who are just as familiar with the American labor laws as their counterparts in management are. And while an individual has very little leverage in negotiations, again, most companies can do with one less worker, collectively an entire workforce has the ability to shut down or at least slow down a company's operations if management chooses not to negotiate in good faith, as is often the case. It's not difficult to quantify the difference between what most hourly employees take home and what the free market would dictate. Economists Lawrence Mischel and Matthew Walters estimate the union wage premium, the amount of additional pay that a unionized worker receives compared to a similar worker who's not a member of a union, at around 20%. If one includes benefits, health care, paid vacations, etc., union members make almost 30% more than their non-union counterparts. Millions of American families are scraping by on below-market wages. If that weren't the case, there wouldn't be such a large group of American families among the working poor. In economic theory, it's a given that a producer can't sell his or her wares below the cost of production. The equivalent to the cost of producing a gizmo, when we're talking about the sale of one's working hours, is the cost of providing basic necessities: nutritious food, safe housing, and decent medical care. These are out of reach for the almost 3 million American families who work full-time and live beneath the poverty level. According to the Working Poor Families Project, half the working poor have no health insurance. Unionization doesn't just boost the income of union members. When an industry has a certain threshold of unionization, all workers, whether unionized or not, end up with a fairer share of the pie. Mischel and Matthew point out that a high school graduate who doesn't belong to a union but works in an industry that has a rate of union membership of 25% or higher brings home 5% more in wages than a similar worker in a less unionized industry. Those are the tangibles, but there are intangibles as well. When enough workers are organized and can speak with one voice, they represent a powerful influence on the political establishment, one that's largely absent in America today. Inequality, stagnant wages, out-of-reach healthcare costs, rising prices for food and energy, dwindling opportunities to get an affordable, high-quality education, and a host of other issues that have a real impact on most American families are all issues that a healthy labor movement can force politicians to address. Union members are more likely to vote their economic interest than to be dazzled by culture war issues. In 2004, while Bush won the votes of 78% of white evangelical Christians, John Kerry won a slim majority among those who also belong to union households. There's a substantial body of research that shows a clear correlation between falling unionization rates, stagnating wages, and increases in inequality and poverty. That's true in all countries. Data from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, shows that countries with high levels of union density or collective bargaining coverage are much more equal than countries with low union density, but perform no worse in terms of creating jobs. The OECD finds that gaps between higher and lower paid workers are lowest where union density is high, and bargaining is either centralized or closely coordinated. For example, the top 10% of male full-time workers earn at least 4.6 times as much as the bottom 10% in the U.S., compared to 3.7 times as much in Canada, 2.9 times as much in Germany, and just 2.3 times as much in Sweden. High union density also narrows pay gaps between men and women and between younger and older workers. By narrowing pay gaps, unions counter poverty and make family incomes much more equal than would otherwise be the case. The United States has seen a precipitous decline in the labor movement over the last three decades or so. That decline has correlated with painful economic stagnation for all but the top of the economic food chain. As economists Lawrence Mitchell and Ross Eisenbray wrote, wage inequality began to grow at the same time that the decline in unionization gathered steam in the late 1970s. Economists Emmanuel Saez and Thomas Piketty showed that when you lop off those in the top 10% of the economic food chain, inflation-adjusted earnings for the overwhelming majority of Americans increased by less than $1,000 over the 28-year period between 1977 and 2005, $35 in growth per year, despite slow but steady economic expansion overall. During this period, the distribution of America's total income has become highly concentrated at the top. In 1977, the top 1% of Americans grabbed just under 8% of the nation's earnings. By 2005, that number had more than doubled to almost 18% of the pie. These numbers don't include investment income, just income from working. So the top 10% actually grabbed about a third of the nation's income in 1977 and almost 45% by 2005. Okay, I guess I have to remember to hit the dump button when that's going to happen. That'll sound great on the podcast, won't it? Anyway, that was also a period in which economic mobility in the United States essentially became a thing of the past, true only in American lore. We now live in one of the least upwardly mobile economies in the wealthy world. A good union job was once a ladder up from poverty to the middle class, but no more. None of this is by accident. Union busting has reached a high art form in the United States. Companies no longer need thugs and gun-toting Pinkerton guards to keep workers from exercising their legal rights to unionize. Now they have high-priced Armani-wearing lawyers to do the job. The tactics are as subtle as they are insidious. A study by Cornell University labor scholar Kate Bronfenbrenner found that 9 in 10 employers facing a union campaign force employees to attend closed-door meetings to hear anti-union propaganda. 80% train supervisors on how to attack unions and require them to deliver anti-union messages to the workers they oversee. Half of employers threaten to shut down the plant if workers organize. And 3 out of 4 hire outside consultants to run anti-union campaigns, often based on mass psychology and distorting the law. Increasingly, cunning forms of intimidation are often enough to produce a no vote. If organizers manage to get and win a vote among workers to unionize, management is able to dispute the outcome, and the case can drag on, often for years. While it's pending, pro-union workers lose their jobs. A study published by economists John Schmidt and Ben Zipperer found that almost 1 in 5 union organizers or activists expect to be fired as a result of their activities in a union election campaign. That's illegal. But since the Reagan administration, U.S. labor protections have been thoroughly gutted, and companies that cross the line pay only modest penalties that can be written off as part of the cost of remaining union-free. Harvard economist Richard Freeman surveyed a number of studies of working people's attitudes in 2005 and found that more American workers want to join a union than ever before, 53%. It's their right, guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution. But even as the numbers who want to bargain collectively with their bosses have increased, the labor movement has continued its deep decline. That's a result of coercion, plain and simple. When there's coercion present in a transaction, that's a rigged market, not a free one. The Employee Free Choice Act, EFCA, is simple. It beefs up penalties for employers who violate workers' rights under the law, creates a mediation and arbitration system for disputes, and allows workers to form a union if a majority simply signs a card saying they want representation. This bill alone won't reverse the long decline of American labor, but it would be a huge step in the right direction. In addition to flooding the airwaves with attack ads in states and districts where business-friendly candidates are on the bubble, we can also expect millions of dollars from that corporate war chest to go into issue ads, part of a concerted effort of anti-union propaganda designed to convince working people that organized labor will cost them wages and jobs, and that union organizers are corrupt and self-serving. As the AFL-CIO notes, the legislation is under attack by an anti-union network that includes discredited groups such as the Center for Union Facts, led by lobbyist Richard Berman, who was infamous for fighting against drunken driving laws and consumer and health protections, and the National Right to Work Committee and Foundation, the country's oldest organization dedicated exclusively to destroying unions. Berman, a hired gun who has battled Mothers Against Drunk Driving on behalf of the alcohol industry, fought smoking bans at the behest of the tobacco industry, and even defended dangerous levels of mercury in fish, expects to raise $30 million for the fight, according to the National Journal. The Center for Union Facts is positively Orwellian in its spin. In one instance, Berman cited a Department of Labor report to claim that unions had racked up $400 million in labor racketeering fines and civil restitution in the last 5 years. Nate Newman, a pro-labor journalist, dug into the report, only to find that almost all of the big money associated with the $400 million figure in labor racketeering was committed by private industry against unions, not by union officials. But, Newman added, that's how you lie with statistics. As far as the movement to defeat EFCA goes, the big lie is that the card check provisions are anti-democratic. The coalition's approach is to make no mention of beefing up penalties for violating workers' rights or creating new dispute settlement procedures. Instead, they seize on a compelling talking point tailored to America's political culture, that the card check provision of the EFCA does away with the secret ballots that Americans have come to expect when casting their votes. Big Business commissioned a Zogby poll that's dangerously close to the political push polls of campaign infamy. The questions were remarkably dishonest, and the results were what the pollsters and their clients were looking for. Please tell me whether you agree or disagree with the following statement. Every worker should continue to have a right to a federally supervised secret ballot election when deciding whether to organize a union. 9 out of 10 respondents agreed, including 87% of Democrats. That's to be expected. The strategy is to depict management's assault on the stability to organize as protecting workers' rights. 7 out of 10 respondents said they'd be less likely to vote for a member of Congress who voted in favor of taking away a worker's right to have a federally supervised secret ballot election to decide whether to organize a union. Armed with their push poll, the rights noise machine has been typically disciplined. All corners of the conservative movement are on message. Big labor wants to do away with secret ballots, and it's pulling the Democrats' strings to make it happen. But as Stalin said, it's not the people who vote that count, it's the people who count the votes. More importantly, it's how the votes are counted, and whether voters are being coerced. The secret ballot election process is almost impossible in today's anti-union environment, with a National Labor Relations Board that's hopelessly stacked with anti-union appointees. As journalist Jordan Barab noted, as a result of an elections process that disenfranchises millions of working people, card check campaigns instead of secret ballot elections have become labor's main tool for organizing the unorganized. According to AFL-CIO statistics cited by Barab, card checks were used to sign up roughly 70% of the private sector workers who joined unions in 2006, compared to less than 5% 2 decades ago. In his book, The Conservative Nanny State, Dean Baker, co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, argues that progressives are way off the mark when they accuse the corporate right of being free market fundamentalists. Baker told me in an interview, "When we say they're market fundamentalists, we're acting like they're willing to accept market outcomes. In reality, conservatives have rigged the deck. They've made sure that certain people come out ahead, that income flows upward, and that other people are put at a disadvantage. These things are built into the rules of the system. The rules of the game, working people's right to negotiate collectively on even ground with employers, is what will be at stake over the next year. We may well see EFCA and other progressive legislation get shot down. But if not, then there's a potential to halt the systematic dismantling of the New Deal's labor protections that we've witnessed over the past 40 years and reverse the spiraling inequality that's accompanied it. Whatever the outcome, we're in for a bloody fight. And once again, y'all, that was Joshua Holland writing at alternate.org. Corporate America prepares for battle against worker campaign to roll back assault on the middle class. It's 5 minutes to seven. This is Dean Farrell. You're listening to Naked Lunch Radio on WHUS 91.7 FM.
Boom, boom, doo-doo, boom, 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 we plant the food, we drive the cab, we load the ship, we run the lab, we build the bridges, we fly the plane, we do the work. This is our day, we do the work. Boom, boom. We do the work. Boom, boom. We do the work. This is our day. We type the page. We clean the streets. We sew the clothes. We change the sheets. We sell the goods. Yes, we do. We lay the stone. We do the work. This is our home. We do the work. We do the work.
We do the work.
We do the work.
We do the work. This is our home.
And with John Fromer singing We Do the Work, we come to the end of this week's Naked Lunch Radio. As always, I just want to remind you any opinions you might hear on this show, whether expressed by yours truly or by the writers I read, do not necessarily reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of WHUS. This is Dean Farrell, and if you'd like to touch base with me, your best bet would be to drop me an email. My address is nakedlunchradio@hotmail.com. That's where to send your questions, comments, suggestions, complaints, obscene remarks about my mother, death threats, or what have you. NakedLunchRadio@hotmail.com. You're listening to WHUS Stores, 91.7 FM, Yukon's radio for the people. I'll be back next Saturday at 6 for another hour of Naked Lunch Radio. This is your only warning.